Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
So we just had the episode with Cain and Abel. Yeah? Remember those guys?
Yeah.
The first two children, right, that had parents in our sacred mythology. And as usual, siblings got along really well. Right? And that's always our story, right? Brothers get along super well. So Cain kills Abel out of, right, jealousy about Abel's offering having been accepted and Cain's not. So we jump in immediately after that event.
Cain was intimate with his wife who became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. He became the founder of a city and he named the city after his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begat Mechayel, and Mechayel begat Methuselah, and Methushael begat Lamech. Lamech took two wives. One was named Adah, and the other was named Zillah. Adah bore Jabal. He was the progenitor of tent dwellers and herders. And his brother's name was Jubal. He was the progenitor of all who play the lute and the long flute. As for Zillah, she too bore Tubal Cain, a smith, progenitor of every artisan who makes copper and iron tools, and Naama was Tubal Cain's sister. Now Lamech said to his wives Adah and Zillah, "Hearken to me, wives of Lamech, give ear to my speech. Because of my bruise, I've slain a man. Because of my wound, a lad. Cain is avenged sevenfold, and Lamech 77."
As I said, the third triennial division is often obscure. Yeah, it's obscure.
Right. Why are there forward slashes in my text?
Why are there forward slashes?
In the translation. It's poetic. Yes, they're not there in the Hebrew.
Right, because it's written slightly differently. But let's... All right, so let's look at 17. So we're getting right to the continuation of the line that in a lot of ancient tradition in the ancient Near East, the people who are responsible for culture are not humans, right? They are divine benefactors that give. Think about fire in Greek mythology, right? How do we get fire?
Prometheus
steals it. From the gods, right? So this is, you know, that a lot of the early invention of culture and of civilization comes from divine benefaction.
Because
it's magic. Or it's tied to something beyond the human, anyway. And so scholars believe part of the reason for putting this particular genealogy in here is to counteract any such thought by early Israel, right? There is not only not divine benefaction other than God giving us life, but we're going to show and name all of the generations of humanity, connecting it directly to Cain, right? And saying, here's, right? These are human beings. They are completely and totally human, and they are responsible for this is where it came from. They're responsible for the earliest forms of culture. That we have, right? These names are, some of them are completely obscure. Some of them make a little bit of sense. But genealogy is always, always critical. Who's usually responsible for genealogies? Which author? Which author is usually responsible in Torah for the genealogies? J, E, P, or D? Who? It's always, usually, P. The priestly source is usually responsible for genealogies.
Christian religion also keeps track of all.
They care. The priestly author cares very much to tie people to other people. They care very much in the priestly school for who descends from whom, and usually there's a reason to tie it back. So tying some of these genealogies all the way back, and we're going to see another genealogy to Noah. So it's really important to have a genealogy before Noah. Why? So we need to tie all of humanity back
to Adam.
To Adam. It's so the genealogy has to be from Adam to Noah. Right. Mm-hmm. Everyone's destroyed but Noah and his family, which ties all of humanity back to Adam. Why is that important?
We're all one family.
We are all one human family. This is a critical message of even early Israel. That we are all of humanity descends from one human being. So that ultimately there is never an argument for my ancestors are better than your ancestors. And there's a rabbinic debate about what is the most important precept of Torah in the Talmud. And one rabbi argues that it is, Ve'ahavta le're'echa kamocha, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And another rabbi argues, it's that we all tie back to Adam. Because ve'ahavta le'recha kamocha is already dependent on I'm going to treat my neighbor as myself. That's out of some kind of idea that we should all be equal. The other rabbi seems to be arguing, but if you're equal, in fact, ve'ahavta le'recha kamocha flows from that logically. Right, so the most important precept is, no, it's not a behavior, it's not an attitude. We are, in fact, all related. And so you should love your neighbor as yourself, since your kin would make complete sense. So that's not the place to start. The place to start is we are one human family.
Rabbi, so if we're one human family, why are we supposedly chosen?
So it doesn't mean we're not different, right? It doesn't mean we don't have different experiences. And certainly as people proliferate or whatever that is, and become different cultures. Remember, we had the Tower of Babel. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing with the Tower of Babel was that everybody was too much the same. That became a problem. Mm-hmm. Right, and so God disperses everybody and gives them different languages so that they didn't understand each other anymore, which is apparently how it's supposed to be. So diversity in human experience is actually right there in Torah as an ideal. Like, it's a good thing, because when we're all too much the same, I think of Nazi Germany. Right, when everybody's too much the same and thinking too much the same, and there's no difference and there's no distinction, then there's really no conversation.
Or the Republican Party.
Or any party, right? Any party that gets too, everyone thinking in lockstep, then really terrible, terrible things can happen.
Was there a different source or what? Or I always thought the reason to tie back to Adam, as you said, was not so much Adam, but tying back to God's creation of the earth. Therefore, he owns the earth. Therefore, he can give it. He can assign it to us. It's his. We borrow it. We use it, etc. Was it a different source that had that philosophy for why the inheritance was so important to go all the way back, or the same source, just a different message?
So I think I need to argue it the other way, which is the early Israelites were dealing with answering, right? That their mythology had to answer some surrounding mythologies in terms of it being distinct. So Adam, the story of Adam and God being completely in control, that already is divergent from many versions of the creation narrative that were in the neighborhood. It's not the genealogy part that early Israel would have made a distinction around. It's Adam's actual creation. That there's no other God involved in Adam's creation is a different version of things than what we've seen in the ancient Near East, because there's always a creatress. There's the goddess. And so in many versions, she gets slain, right? Tiamat gets slain, and half of her body makes the heavens and half of her body makes the earth. So there's something that happens before the God create, right? So anyway, what was my point? So the the creation of Adam by a single deity who acts alone is what makes Adam and the earth and everything, and God creating the earth alone is what makes it clear that all of it belongs to God. And we're going to see some more of that when the earth is destroyed, right? That it all belongs to God, and God gets to do whatever God wants to do with it. I can tell it was completely unsatisfying as an answer. I don't know of another place where genealogies are used to point to it all belonging to God. Does that make sense? But Adam belonging to God, Chava belonging to God, all of creation belonging to God, right, that is a foundational and in some ways revolutionary idea. Okay. Yes?
So there were two foundational ideas. This and the fact that we're all one community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing about the distinction piece, like, it's really coming up to me right now. I'm an individual in my own chair, my own spot in this room. Mm-hmm. I have my own questions about the process, but I hear your questions, and I treat them as another part of the idea that I don't yet understand. And so I really feel myself in community. And, like, I think the benefit, or even like you're saying, the necessity of the distinction is we all need each other to fully, like, even there's another point about each one and a half shekel, that I feel that right now. And so as you guys ask, I'm like really grateful for the questions you're asking. So thank you.
There's a beautiful teaching by, I believe it's Peter Pizzola, who says when we study Torah, part of why we don't study Torah alone is for exactly that reason,
yes.
Right? That in listening to someone else's question or listening to someone else's insight, right, that already changes my relationship to the text, because each of us can only ever experience the text as a mirror. We can all only, each of us, ever experience this text as a reflection of our own questions, our own challenges, our own longings, our own whatever, until we study together. Then your mirror becomes my window. Right? So that I don't see the text mirrored the way you see it, but because you are willing to share that out loud, it becomes a window for me into someone else's mirror.
Yeah,
I just mangled that, I'm sure, but into someone else's window. Thank you. Stay with window. Right? Which I think was the point of the rabbis, right, having us commanded to study Torah,
right,
and to read Torah out loud together, right? Like, I think that was part of the point, is that we weren't supposed to have our own unique individual interpretation that never goes anywhere else, because what's that? Right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's lovely, but
well, it's like as post World War II, here I am, human, like reading Torah. Like, there's the part of me that was told get A's. I grew up get A's, be smart around Torah. Be smart so that I can let the walls down of my intellect and be like the spiritual, like whatever we create through that. It's like less what than more how.
Well, and the what, because the what stops being my achievement.
Yes.
My report card. The what starts to be community, understanding, truth,
right.
Search, longing, right? That we've pointed to the wrong thing in our country, right? We've in our culture, we've pointed to success. You need to succeed, and that means you need A's. That's very different from an actual pursuit of knowledge, wisdom, understanding, right? It's very different. And it's very non-rabbinic. It's very non-rabbinic to say you're doing all this to achieve. Right? You're doing all this so that you can understand the will of God better. So that you can live your life in alignment with whatever the divine would be calling from us. That's the point of this, ultimately. So we understand ourselves better. We understand our motivations. We understand our inclinations. We understand our challenges, right? Our longings, our...
And the only way to really understand it is to be in community and discussing it and
turning it upside down.
Yeah. Indeed. Indeed. All right. Okay, let's go to 25.
Adam once again was intimate with his wife, and she bore a son and gave him the name Seth, since God has given me another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain had slain him. As for Seth, to him too was born a son, and he named him Enosh. then it was that people began to invoke Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. This is the written record of the human line from the day God created human beings, making them in the likeness of God, creating them male and female, blessing them, and naming them humans on the day they were created. Adam had lived 130 years when he begot in his likeness after his image, when he begot in his likeness after his image, and he named him Seth. After begetting Seth, Adam lived 800 years, and he begot sons and daughters. The years of Adam's life came to 930, then he died.
Okay. So most ancient Near Eastern cultures have an understanding that everything that is pre-flood, people lived a whole lot longer. A whole lot longer than after the flood. The antediluvian lifespan is way longer. So the flood is not just an event. The flood is a judgment on human capacity to live along, on human longevity, right? It's a judgment. The most you're going to get after the flood is how much? 120
years. Motion.
So 930, right, is in ancient Near Eastern terms is young for pre-flood people. The period covered by our pre-flood period is a lot smaller than other cultures who have like 400,000 years to account for between creation and flood. So our people lived a lot shorter. So 930 is actually short. A child.
What's the definition of a year? People do a lunar calendar, and do they, in both Torah and elsewhere in Near Eastern cultures, do they count years differently than we?
It's a 12-month cycle. So that's exactly what they're talking about here. Where people want to start fudging that stuff is when you start looking at creation and you're talking about a day. Like, well, what's a day? A day is evening to morning. I mean, evening to evening, that's a day. But, you know, but people who need to defend the text need to start saying, well, a day might have been an epic. Like, it might have been 1,000 years. No. Like, a day is a day. And a year was a 12-month cycle. Yeah.
I have a question. Right before five, the last word, then it was that people began to invoke. Mm-hmm.
Why then?
What is that about?
Yep, good idea. What do you think?
I have no idea. It jumped out.
Yeah, right. Right. So monotheism, right? Yes. Were you going to say something, Bert?
Is this the first time Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh appears in Torah?
I don't know. You'd have to look at the creation narrative
because
and see if it happens
it's
in
Elohim enough. At the beginning. When?
Anyway, it is so. It is clear that Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is pre-Abrahamic, right? So it doesn't come on the scene with Abraham. It's there really early, says our author. Yeah. That Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the awareness of human beings that Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is the creator, monotheism, if you will, is there early. There's nothing else that our later folk supplant in terms of early human relationship to the one. Right?
I just looked and this is not the first time.
That was my suspicion.
Not even close.
It's reference to God. Began to invoke.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's not the first time the word appears.
No.
Right.
What does the word invoke? Does it mean?
It isn't here in Hebrew. It's likro b'shem Adonai. To call on the name of God. To call God's name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now, I'm sure that invoke isn't wrong. God forbid I would call the translators wrong. But it's, you know what I mean? But there isn't a verb that's really invoke here. Again, English being a language of breadth, Hebrew being a language of get straight to the point, right? So they pick a word that probably means something close to that. But likro b'shem Adonai, to call, right, the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh.
And it's not like a name like your name is Amy and my name is Bert. The name here, what does name mean? I mean, it's not the label. We use name in English mostly to mean label.
So it's, I mean, we've talked a lot about name being essence. Name is something about calling on the essence of someone, and in this case, something. And it seems that humanity, Mark, to get a little closer to your question, it seems like humanity had to get to a certain point before they apprehend the nature, right? The essence,
yes,
of what divinity is, and it's significant that it's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh that is chosen, not Elohim. Why is that significant? Why didn't it just say Elohim?
Because it's what it means. Was, is, and will be.
It's acknowledging the lack of boundaries.
Well, and Elohim could have a different interpretation. Right? Elohim, gods.
It's plural.
Yeah. It could mean something else, right? Like there's a little room for, you know, what does that mean exactly? When you say Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, it's very clear who we're talking about here, right? This is the God of Israel. This is the one, the creator, right? There's no room to misinterpret who we're dealing with or who they apprehended as the creator God. It's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh.
Elohim is a previous concept of gods.
Correct. So, like that could leave a little too much open to interpretation, right? If you use El, are we talking about the Canaanite El? Are we talking about like maybe it's the same God? It's like God forbid, right? It's got to be much more specific.
Names through this lineage, there became this deeper pursuit of God. I mean, because the name God was played out in all kinds of cultures going on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But for whatever reason, this line through this continuity became in touch with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh.
But there's a lot of contact before this. I mean, there's Adam and Eve talking to God, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is talking to them, and they're talking back to
you. Yeah, it's not the first contact.
Right. This, I think,
it's clearly thinking about a different understanding.
It's a deeper connection than what we had before. I think that's
right. Linda's had her hand up. Yes.
Does Elohim appear in the Torah anywhere other than at that
point? Yes. Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or Vayehi Or.
Right. Okay.
From the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Well, I once heard a very interesting conversation about the distinction between Elohim and Adonai. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and that Elohim talks about just the grand atmosphere, the cosmos of the earth, where humans live, and Adonai was the real connection, the visceral connection between the humans and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and that's when the differences of the use of the Elohim versus Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh.
You were right until then. So Rabbi Harold Schulweis of Blessed Memory has an article you can look up that says Adonai Elohim.
Who I heard discuss that.
Right. So he's not saying that's when you got different names. We got different names from different authors.
No, but how the interpretation was that Elohim referred to a whole different...
It was Schulweis's reworking of those names to have a theology that we could live with. It has nothing to do with the origin or the meaning in the Torah of those names. Nothing at all. He meant we can take, how can bad things happen to good people if God is everything and the creator and whatever? How can God be good and just if bad things happen to good people? It's that same old question. Okay. And so Schulweis gets to it by saying, because there's different aspects of the divine. One is a world, Elohim, that has cancer in it. And cancer reproduces in human bodies. That's Elohim. That's how the world is put together. Adonai is in the doctors, is in the people who show up for us, is in, right? Like it, he's distinguishing those names in order to say God is in both, but they're different. It's not, they're not different, God forbid. They're part of the same reality, capital R, But some things are godly, just they just exist and they're not good or bad. Then there's Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which is the imminent relational good part of
that's what I was trying to
divinity.
Say.
Isn't there also
that's
is
what
it?
Meant. That's what
and
it meant.
I forget which
that's what I heard.
Right, right.
Why do we have Shin on our window instead of
Shaddai? Shaddai became the traditional one to put on the house to guard the house.
Isn't there also an issue with Adonai and Elohim of the aspect of compassion and the aspect of strict justice?
So that's where the Kabbalists go. Mm. Right, is that the flavor of God that is Din is Elohim, the flavor of God that is Rachamim is mercy is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh.
Shema has both.
I want to try to nail down this question of back then, what was the terminology that the Bible uses? Invoked God. Does this mean, because it gets to the heart of this, that those individuals pre-flood in the had a relationship with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So Abraham really wasn't the first person that had a relationship. It went all the way back. You
know? Sure. I mean, Noah.
Well, Adam and Eve.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It's from the beginning. Right? Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So what's the Hebrew for the beginning of chapter 5? Ze Sefer Toldot Adam. Whenever we see Sefer, it means a written tradition, not an oral tradition. So there exists somewhere, once upon a time, Sefer Toldot Adam. So is our version taken from some other version and reworked? Is it taken from several different versions? There's a tradition of Sefer Toldot Adam, the genealogy of Adam. We're going to get 10 generations. This was very common in the ancient Near East. 10 generations is a very common number between one huge event and the next like big thing in human history. Right? In our case, it's Adam and the creation of the world to the flood to Noah who will survive the flood.
That's 10 generations.
That's 10 generations, right? And so this is a very common, we have a list of Sumerian kings, 10 generations, very much in this format. This is a very familiar thing in the ancient world. So you'd have to have the Israelite one, right? I mean, if it's that common in your sacred literature, you better have your version, or you look like
you're not with it,
right? Like, what's that? So you got to have the 10 generation genealogy. Hello. So we're getting ours, right? And so we're not going to go through the whole thing.
Question?
Yes.
The English says likeness of God.
Uh huh.
If I'm reading the Hebrew properly, it's not Betzel Elohim that we're used to seeing, or we saw earlier. It's a different word. Is it
Dmut?
Right. Is it the same thing, or because we always make such a thing as we're made in the image of God?
So the notes that I've read say that it's most likely about the alliteration of Adam b'dmut, right? Taking out tselem, but that it makes it a little more alliterative. But what my favorite part is, right, is so God creates Adam bitmut Elohim asa'oto, right? God makes Adam in God's image. Zachar unekeva bar'am. Male and female, God created them. Right? It doesn't say after Adam and then God created Chava.
Mm-hmm. So in his image, though.
Yeah. Of course. Right? Of course we're created in God's image.
There's not a his.
Oh, yes, I mean,
you added that.
No, I say that because I was born saying that.
Yeah. Right, it sounded like there was something there, like that.
Well, I mean,
in God's image, though. Like what?
God is having no human image.
So of course, God forbid, God should have a human image. So what must it mean?
That we have divine in us.
God forbid God has a human form. God forbid. So it must mean something else. Like for the rabbis, it must mean something else. If we say God has a physical form, we're heretics, right? We're apikorsim. So it must mean, by definition, something else. So it must mean us being in the image and likeness of God is some other aspect of ourselves, although the Jewish tradition has always seen the body as spiritual and as divine and as holy, and right, we revere this physical form that we are gifted, and it's not like it's less because it's not the image of God. So it's more like our totality somehow is created in the image of God, right? A reflection is always in some ways a distortion, right? But you know, but definitely for them it's the soul, it's the spirit, it's the, like all those things that make us divine.
But we have the ability to do godly deeds. We act in a godly manner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. George? Uh-oh, you look concerned.
I want to go back to something that much of it I don't understand, but the specific. In the first, when hearken to me, the wives of Lamech, give ear to my speech because of my bruise. I've slain a man because of my wound, the lad. Cain is avenged sevenfold in Lamech 77. I don't understand. Does that mean if I kill someone, I could, and then if I have kids, that makes up for killing someone?
Most likely, this is the remnant of a much larger epic poem, and it's a hero tale. It's a hero tale. So all heroes slay somebody, right? And I mean, you just have to have that in a hero tale, right? And
every culture has them.
And it is, it's the beginning of kind of a commentary on where humanity is going, right? This is the beginning of humanity starting to kind of come apart and decay morally. Right, kind of that celebration. Yes, look at me. I'm so strong. I'll avenge somebody. Like, it's the beginning of the decline that leads to the flood. It's early, right? It's already here. That it's beginning. You know, the kind of. Right. It's. Well, it's not a good thing. This is not a good thing. This is not something that we celebrate. This is an indication that already things are starting to unravel for human beings. Right? Like, yeah, we don't lift this up as, ooh, yeah, this is what we're going for, right? That it's an indication that stuff is already messed up. And that, yeah, the shedding blood to avenge other blood, right, is already here.
Amy, are we supposed to read Genesis from the point of view that it's being written by a historian as opposed to a theologian?
Us?
Genesis itself. It reads, in other words, there's no concept here of monotheism, probably until Abraham. It just seems like it's written deliberately to say, this is who we are, this is where we came from, and there's no assertion that there is one God.
Okay, so there is an assertion that there's one God.
Yes, there is.
Definitely. Yeah. There's and that's part of the point of the story, is there's one God created heaven and earth and all of humanity. One God. So nobody else.
Where did the other gods come in with regard to our people who were always praying to other gods prior?
Because they were exposed to other people's gods,
through
right?
Their migration through living where they lived.
Sure. Like, yeah, their development of their culture and their religion. I think what sometimes we forget is that we look at this book in a vacuum.
Yeah.
We take this to mean, what does it say? How are we supposed to read it? Which are all good questions, but it didn't come out of nowhere. This was our version of a very popular book that was already going around for thousands of years. First as oral tradition, right, then as written tradition. But this is just our version of what is already in the neighborhood. The flood is already established. We didn't make up a story about a flood, right? Everyone knew there was a flood. Well, of course, right? There's antediluvian and post-diluvian. Everyone knows that. And everyone knows people live 900 years or 10,000 years before the flood, and everyone knows life is a lot shorter. There are things that are just taken for granted in the early Israelite setting that make our story make sense. It doesn't make sense to us, right? We have to know all that before we get, like, why this is here, and why would someone write that?
But there's no imposition by God saying, I've created you, believe only in me.
In later books, we get that all the time.
But not in Genesis.
Well,
not in the first chapter.
You know, is the call to Abraham, you can worship whoever you want? No.
No, right.
Right? Only me. And your kids and grandkids had better worship only me. Right, right?
No,
so it's
Adam and Eve are the only human beings, and God talks to them in the Garden of Eden. And nobody else is around.
Yeah, we're not supposed to read anything from this, that there's a demand that you only pray to one God.
The explicit command is not yet given, but you can't read this outside of that explicit command. The people who wrote that command wrote this. That's what I'm saying. We get all tangled up. The people who wrote, you shall only worship Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh as your God, wrote this text. They wrote this text to be evidence that only Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh existed at the time of the birth of the world. No other God. Therefore, why in the world would you worship another God when only Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was on the scene?
So that fact that it was that they did worship other gods is only cultural. It's not written in any way.
Correct. Correct.
Well, but what's written certainly reflects the fact that people were worshiping multiple gods.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. When this is written, people are worshiping other gods.
Yes. Right. This new proposition.
And who was worshiping other gods? Oh yeah, Israel.
Right. Of course.
That's my point. Oh yeah, the ones who wrote this text.
Right.
Right. Right. Okay.
They were still carrying them around.
Right. Mickey, one thing, and then we're going to push on. Oh my God! Look at the time. Yes, Mickey.
Well, the word Demut.
I'm sorry?
The root word Demut is Dam. Blood. It seems like it's creating a bloodline.
It's Dame.
Dame.
Similar. Dame. Demut comes from Dame, to be similar. Ze Dome le Ze. Right? This is similar to that. I don't think the etymology is Dam.
Okay,
I don't think it's blood.
We're creating a bloodline with all the.
That's a lovely midrash. Write it up, and we'll add it. All right. I want to push on because I want us to get to... poor God. Sorry for God. I know, it's bad. Like, it's going to be a hard year for Torah, I think. Like, the way I, like, had to deal with Moshe this year, and now I'm feeling super bad for God. Okay, so... Bert, you want to read at 6?
Chapter 6?
Yes.
Oh, chapter.
And nobody freak out on me. We're going to get through it.
I can find you. Oh, okay. Now, as people began to multiply on the earth, daughters were born to them. And when the divine beings saw how fair were the human women, they took wives for themselves as they chose. Then Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh said, my spirit will not forever endure the humans, as they are but fallible flesh. Their lifespan shall be only 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and afterward too, when the divine beings mated with the human women, they bore for them those heroes who from of old enjoyed great renown.
All right.
Wait.
I was waiting for it. All right. So... Right. All right. So people are increasing. Right. We're doing exactly what we're told. Because and somehow I skipped over that wonderful Zachar and Nekeva business. Right. So male and female, God created them. So the earthling, it's another argument for the earthling, Adam, possibly being hermaphroditic. God creates Adam, Zachar, Unecheva, Bar'am. Male and female, God created them. So it is, right, another place to get the midrash that how does God create male and female? By splitting the earthling in half. that was originally Zachar and Nekeva, male and female. All right. So what? And then it said there, and we skipped over a little bit. And God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply." So then the 10 generations that we get are a fulfillment of that commandment, right? Human beings do. They are blessed, and they do exactly what they're supposed to do. They procreate. They have lots of sons and daughters, right? So now, chapter 6, they're increasing, right?
Yeah. This is like coming in from left field. It's coming in from nowhere.
Well, it can't be coming in from
nowhere. I mean, it seems to.
Because it says, Vayir'u v'nei ha-Elohim et benot ha-Adam, and gives us zero explanation of who these sons, children of ha-Elohim. We have a divine article in front of Elohim. And it's funny, a lot of articles you look at just say b'nei Elohim. It's like, no, it says b'nei ha-Elohim. The definite article tells us that this was an already established and well-known business. We don't get any explanation. It seems like it comes out of left field, but it isn't. If you're writing a text and you go, you know, that melody was as simple as Mary Had a Little Lamb, and you go on. Okay, if you don't define Mary Had a Little Lamb, and you throw it in there, it means everybody knows what Mary Had a Little Lamb means, right? Everyone knows that song. Or you would have to explain it. So it is very obvious whenever we get something like this that comes in like feeling out of left field with zero explanation, we all go, what? It is something that is very well known to the ancient reader, who wouldn't have been reading, but to the ancient world, right? So let's just accept that there's something about B'nai HaElohim, these children of God, somehow, these divine beings, some people want to call them divine beings, and they saw the daughters of Adam, right? Benot ha-Adam, human daughters, human females, ki tovotena, that they are tov. Right? They are very tov. Vayikhu lahem nashim mikol asher baharu. And they took for themselves women, mikol asher baharu, from among all that they chose. Right? So it's like a buffet, essentially.
I'm assuming the women had no choice. It doesn't say they did.
There's arguments about this. So there's arguments about this. Some want to say they took them as nashim, wives, so that there was nothing wrong happening. That they took them as wives, that because they were attractive. Other people want to say these were the generation of don't read B'nai Elohim as being somehow divine beings, God forbid. They were just huge personalities, like leaders, revered people. And those revered people misused their position. Could you imagine such a thing? Wow. Misused their position and authority and power and did to human females whatever they wanted to. Oh my God. I want you to suspend your disbelief for a moment and pretend that this is possible.
They felt entitled. They were judged.
So on some level, there are people who want to interpret this text as this is another piece of evidence and another way that humanity has fallen from God's original intention, right? And if we hold a reading like that in mind, I'm telling you, like, imagine God. Like, really? Really? This is what I create? I gave you life. I gave you a piece of me. I gave you my ruach. I breathed life. And this is what it's come to? Really? So if we hold that, we can get to the next part about what's happening for God. But even if they are divine beings, and some folks want to read these as divine beings, the rabbis have all these midrashim where the angels say, "See, we told you you shouldn't have created human beings. You see what happens? Especially the males. You see what happens? This is what happens." And God said, "You would be just as tempted by human females if you lived an earthly existence." And they said, "Nuh-uh." And God said, "Yaha, watch this." And made the angels physical and put them on earth. And what happened? They took human females because they were tov, right? And so even the angels couldn't resist human females, right? They couldn't resist their own, you know, sexual, their own lust, if you will. And it's critical that that's the way they chose, right? Not because the women were of excellent character and very bright, right, and very motivated to succeed, right? No, it's because, right, they pleased them, right? Meaning they're objectified, right? They are objects of the B'nai HaElohim's choice and pleasure, not about relationship.
Look how Greek mythology just records.
So it's everywhere, right? It is all over the ancient world, the idea of semi-divine beings having intercourse with human females and giving rise to, right, folks like Nephilim.
Big people.
Right? So lots of people want to jump all over Nephilim being connected to Nafal, to fall. And where do you think Christians go with this? Of course. Fallen angels. Fallen divine beings. These are the offspring of, it would seem, the B'nai HaElohim, and human females are the Nephilim. Heroes. Like, think heroes like, give me one.
Got none.
Hercules.
We're all out.
Rocky.
Thank you. Hercules, right? Hercules. Perfect example. Right, so you know, they are not divine. They are definitely human, but they have
divine
some
quality.
Superpowers, right? They have some divine quality. So that seems to be what our Nephilim are. And these were the heroes of old, the men of renown. So this is where some people pick up on these were the renowned heroes who felt like who became degraded. And others want to say there were the heroes are the offspring of B'nai HaElohim and human females. In either case, I don't really think it's so important because it doesn't seem to be critical to the narrative. I think, it's just my opinion because it's kind of my thing. I think what's important here is that, here it is, right here. Here's why we have this at all. The Lord said what? God said what? My breath shall not abide in man forever. Since he too is flesh, let the days allow him to be 120 years. Why do Adam and Chava get kicked out of the garden?
They ate from the tree.
They ate from the tree.
They
ate from the tree of the knowledge between the difference between good and evil. Why did Chava eat from that tree? Because what did the Nahash say to her?
It tastes good.
You won't die when you eat this. What will happen?
You'll be like smart.
You will be like
God.
God. You will be like God if you eat from this tree. And God banishes them from the garden and places a cherub there with a flaming sword so that what?
They can't get back in.
So they can't back in for what? Get back in for what? It says it specifically. So they can't get back in and eat from the tree of life and live forever. Which to me says they were created mortal. People love to say death is a punishment for sin. I do not believe that. I do not read that text that way. They were born mortal. They ate from the tree that was going to make and made them more like the Nahash didn't lie. The Nahash was right. When we have a knowledge between good and evil, don't we become more like God? Yes. So if they're going to become more like me by eating from that tree when I told them not to, what's going to happen? Wait, then might not they eat from that other tree and live forever? And it was never their destiny to live forever. They're humans. I believe this story is about B'nai HaElohim having intercourse with human females and looking to create humans that might live forever. My soul is not, I mean, my, whatever it is.
My spirit,
right? Ruchi. My spirit is not supposed to live in Adam, more than 120 years, God decides. You got 900 before. But the point, I believe the point is, and same with the Tower of Babel, it's about humanity challenging the limits of being human. And it's okay. We didn't get killed for eating the fruit of the tree of the good, the difference between good and evil. It's okay that we become like God in certain ways. Where it's absolutely off limits is immortality. That is off limits. Any attempts at that, and I believe I would include in that why we can't drink blood or eat blood.
Oh,
that is my own theory, but I believe it's another way ancient peoples might have looked to extend the lifespan was to consume the life force of other living beings.
That's
like vampires. Those myths don't come out of nowhere. And people believed them, right? So I really think that there's a huge line through Torah that we kind of don't really talk about. It's like lots of things living into the image of God is beautiful and wonderful, and we're supposed to. But what's off limits is immortality. You human beings are finite. That is, in fact, the meaning and the beauty of your lives. Because any vampire novels worth their weight, Interview with a Vampire, the best of all time, I'm just going to say, and I will defend it, like, to the mat. So, Interview with a Vampire, why is that book so poignant? Because he suffers. He suffers so much because everything around him is finite. And only he will live forever. He watches it all wither and die around him, and it's unnatural. And he's bored. How long can you live and find things novel? How long can you live and have any urgency around everything if you know you live forever? And it seems to me that Torah's very clear that part of the very meaning and definition of what it is to be human is to be finite.
Yes. How ironic that we're accused of killing children, Christian children, to drink blood.
Right.
Just the irony of that is just...
Yep. Right.
This colors my view of last week's story of Moses' death.
Right? Although none of us had a problem with Moses dying. That wasn't our problem, any of us. What was our problem?
But he didn't get in.
And that's a, you know, that's a consequence of something, and that he doesn't get in.
This partially answers why.
No, nobody had a problem with Moses dying.
Yeah.
People had a problem with Moses dying before he reached the promised land. That he's told, you can look at it, but you don't get to go over, right? I think we made some peace with it by saying, okay, it's a metaphor for none of us really ever gets to go over. But I think everyone was clear that, you know, that Moshe needed to die because the next generation, right? I think we were all clear about that part. All right, so just a little bit more, hang with me just a little bit more. I promise I won't keep you long.
Don't keep us past Alpha.
Don't keep us past 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Bert 5.
When Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh saw how great was the wickedness of human beings in the earth, that the direction of their thoughts was nothing but wicked all the time, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh regretted having made human beings on earth and was heartsick. So Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh thought, I will wipe the humans whom I created off the face of the earth, the humans and with them the beasts, the reptiles, the birds of the sky, for I rue the day I made them. But Noah found favor in Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh's sight.
Okay. I think often when we talk about the flood narrative, like creation to flood, I think often we think of God having a temper tantrum, right? A punishing, wrathful God. And I really want us to step back and remember what God has consistently tried to, like, right, deal with this creation that God has made, and continually they push, right, against the limits to the point that they now have become only Ra, right? This B'nai HaElohim taking human females is just one, it's one level, but take that to its logical, right? What if that's the way the world works, that you just can take whatever you want, do to another human being whatever you want, or just take what, forget it, maybe they agreed, maybe it's not a bad thing for the women, but still to just take what you want, It seems that it's a slippery slope. Just saying. Right, a slippery slope to everything being rock ra. Only evil.
Well,
there's another piece here, and that this is God regretting.
Hey, hang on. So, rock ra. Everything is rock ra kol hayom. Only evil all day long. Kol hayom, all the day. Right? So 24/7, all people are doing is figuring out how I can get what I want next, or how I can take, or how I can, right? So I really am not trying to push this. I think, though, that this is not a new problem. This is, I mean, the corruption in our society is not new. Torah understands it to be the human condition. That's what can happen, right, if we're not careful. I believe Abraham and the covenant becomes an answer and a preventive and a prescription for rock, rock, kol hayom. Left to our own devices, it is not pretty, people, right? Like, without, I believe the Abrahamic covenant is an answer to this issue, that there's just bad, like when we're left with nothing to guide us, right? That is what is going to happen. And so in this case, God, right, to go to Bert's point, I really, Vayinacham, Vayinachem Adonai ki asa et ha'adam. God is sitting in deep regret for what God has done. So God, out of this regret, yit'atzev el libo. God's heart is saddened. God does not destroy the world out of anger. God is devastated that what God imagined as being the most glorious mixture of this new idea of a material being and it, God, has become rock ra, kol hayom, only evil, all day, every day. God is devastated and decides the only thing to do is to start over, to take the best seedling, I didn't mean it to be quite that like graphic, to take, right, the plant that has the most hope, right, that you got, you've got a lot to work with, but take one that looks like it's hopeful, right, and you're gonna raise the field, you're gonna burn the field, and you're gonna plant that one in really fertile soil, right, hoping for a different outcome.
Amy, I'm having trouble trying to reconcile the idea that man is created in the image of God, and yet reading this, it seems that God's belief is that man not only is fallible, but is certainly not neutral. There seems to be a proclivity towards slipping into bad behavior, and it's only, and God gets fed. I don't know how you can tie this together and say you're in my image as a metaphysical idea. Why wouldn't the proclivity be to do good and not do evil? But it seems the authors want you to start seeing man as fallible and fallible only leaning towards bad behavior.
Well, that's what we get pre-flood.
Pre-flood.
We don't have that again. We don't see that again after the flood. We are descendants of after the flood. We are descendants of Noah. We are descendants of the best that was on the planet at the time. So, yeah, right, right. Yeah, right. Not unequivocally, but, I mean, well, no. Well, actually, he was the best among what was there for the time. That's what it says, right? In his generation, right? Tzadik, right? Bidoro, in his generation. So of what was going on, God took the best and started over. We are descendants from that reboot. So it seems to suggest we're maybe a little bit better. It's like humanity 2.0 is an improvement, it seems, over antediluvian reality. So we'll start there. But God is, right, so God is deeply regretful. So I want to say one thing, two things. One, God regrets. So I think there's a lesson here that if we sit in regret, only destruction comes out of it. Hmm. That we, only destruction. And God learns that.
Was this a mistake?
I think so.
I think God decides never to do this again, never to destroy the world by flood again.
I think we're lucky that God hasn't tried to do it again.
God doesn't have to worry about it. We're taking care of that.
Yeah.
We're destroying the world now.
Right.
Yeah, we're doing it for God. So
bring on a flood.
But I don't want to go to the flood. I want to stay here. So regret, right? Regret, if we stay in regret, it can only lead to destruction. Which I think is a really important teaching for our time, right? It's a really powerful teaching. God doesn't do it out of wrath or justice or punishment. God destroys out of sadness and regret. So that's one point. The second is, which I'm going to give you Jonathan Sacks to take with you, why create this at all if the omniscient one must have known that, right, things were going to go badly? Why do this at all is a question we could easily sit with. You heard me talk to it a little bit at Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, whatever, Yom Kippur. So, but this idea that God creates anyway, Rabbi Harold Kushner says, why did God create Eden and put in the middle of Eden a creature with free choice, mm-hmm. and say to that creature, of all the trees in the garden you may eat, but if this one you may not eat, that is just a recipe for disaster. So like, God is certainly smart enough to know that that's a risk, that you could be really regretful, right? Why do that? And Kushner's answer is because God wanted human goodness more than God wanted perfection. Perfection would have been Eden, human beings, animals living in peace, lion laying down with the lamb, everybody gets along. That's perfection. But God wasn't interested in perfection. God was interested in human goodness. And the only way you get human goodness is to give them
a choice.
Is to give them free will, right?
Our and folks are all about this.
And so I think that this, you know, when you talk about regret and like, why would God create knowing that there's going to be all this craziness of nuclear war and all this kind of stuff? And you know that I don't believe in an omniscient, all powerful God. But let's just go with Sacks, who does, right? Sacks believes God is omnipotent and omniscient and all good and all that stuff. Why do it? And I believe Sachs's point is a good one, is because there's gorgeousness in this business anyway, right? And that if there weren't humanity, there could never be a tzaddik of any generation. Mm-hmm. And that we all have, whether we have actual biological children or we participate in raising children, we all put ourselves out there to be hugely disappointed.
Just say.
Wow, that laugh came from a mother of three daughters. Wow, right? That is a knowing laugh right there, people. Right? We put ourselves out to be hugely disappointed. Why? Why bother? All the tsuris and pain and whatever that's going to come from child. My daughter said to me once, why do you like being a mommy? like it's so hard. Like, you work and you cook and you like pick up my stuff. Like, why would you want to do that? Well, I couldn't possibly begin to explain it to her till a certain point in her development, because she was not wrong. It's a sucky job, a lot of it, right? But why do we do it? Why do we risk it? Why do we put ourselves out there knowing we could be devastated and hurt? Because that is the only possibility for goodness.
Because we have the touch of divine from God.
And we are creators, right, in that sense. And like the creator, there can't be a tzaddik, there can't be righteous people, there can't be good kids who are making a difference in this world if we don't risk having them and loving them and raising them, no matter the consequences to us.
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.